Blog Talk Radio.
This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Mary Tabor, author of the just-released novel, Who by Fire. My guest today is the poet extraordinaire, Ravi Shankar. He is here today not only for a conversation about his considerable body of work, but also to talk with me about the creative process, the art of teaching, and his support for the arts. Ravi Shankar is a philanthropist of the heart. Here's what I mean. Yes, he's published highly praised poetry, beginning with his first book, Instrumentality. Here's a line I love from the poem Exile. If, as Simone Weil writes, to be rooted is the most important and least recognized need of the human soul, behold, I am an epiphyte. Then came 30 Stills. In this seamless collection, like Wallace Stevens, Shankar creates his unreal out of what is real. And then amazingly, he blends the poems of this book into another, deepening groove that won the 2009 National Poetry Review Book Prize. Poet Derek Walcott said in a 1997 lecture, "All art has to do with light." Shankar understands this in his work that is luminous, but also in the light he sheds on others. Ravi Shankar has illuminated the work of the poet Ritika Vazirani after her untimely death, an extraordinary collection entitled Radha Says. And he has created a tome of an anthology, Language for a New Century, that illuminates contemporary poetry from the Middle East, Asia, and beyond, 61 countries or territories in all, and that the Nobel Prize winner Nadine Gordimer aptly calls a beautiful achievement for world literature. But that's not all. He is also the force behind the e-zine literary journal Drunken Boat, where he sheds light on the famous next to the emerging, new voices, new takes, light, and hope for writers and readers everywhere. Shankar is poet in residence at Central Connecticut State University, where he co-directs the creative writing program. Now, at this point, you must be asking yourself, how old is he? My answer is old in the wisdom of his heart, young in years. He and I have never met, but Ravi, I'm willing to bet my 401k that you get this line from Leonard Cohen's song, Anthem. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Welcome to Rare Bird Radio, Ravi Shankar.
Why, thank you, Mary. What a wonderful introduction. It's left me a bit speechless, but I certainly hope that I can do my part to continue to illuminate a few things with your listeners today.
Well, we just have to get one thing out of the way right up front, though. You do share a well-known name, so the question is, does that sitar player get really tired of being confused with a famous poet?
Yes. In fact, there's also three Ravi Shankar of The Art of Living, so I think I'm probably the third most famous. But interestingly, I think that early on, kind of being able to disassociate myself from my name gave me part of my nomadic spirit, and I think that's part of why I kind of explore so much. I mean, ultimately, human identity is so much more than what you're labeled, so.
Sure, and names are identity, and you had to do a little bit of separating, I suppose, in that process is what you're describing, and I think that's fascinating in terms of the nature of your work. One of the things that you say about poetry and the purpose of poetry is, I mean, I have taken this a little bit out of context, but you can correct that. You say that it's about building a bridge between the visible and the invisible. Can you talk a little bit about what that means to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I think poetry in its highest calling, I mean, there's always these perennial debates about the death of poetry, or is poetry still relevant? And it's the most timeless of human arts, I believe, because of the kind of musicality and lyricism that was used to pass on oral histories, but also because there was always this kind of reaching towards the unknown. And in the workings out of the poems that I most admire and return to with the greatest pleasure, there's the sense that a dimension that exists in the periphery of your vision. It's nearly spiritual seeking, and that a poem attempts to construct that path, to allow you for a moment to glimpse what was ineffable or what you didn't think you knew before. And in that kind of momentary revelation, I think true epiphany is born. And that for me has always been the purpose of poetry, whether in my own or in others.
And you know, that's the way you phrase that strikes me, the use of the word spirit, that I wonder if you think about writing a little bit the way I do, and that sometimes we really are the vehicles for the writing rather than the writer exactly. Does that jive with you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you can't will those moments, but I think when you have that a time for distilled awareness and something happens and you just have to be there for it, but there is a way in which sometimes the poems are wiser than you actually are. And I think we see this time and time again with poets' lives, right? I mean, in some ways you can't believe Rilke wrote the poems that he did when you hear about some of his horrendous personal relations, and yet music and meaning is, you know, utterly important to me. And I think he crafted some of the most beautiful poems. I mean, they're ones I bring back to my class often.
Me too. I read him over and over and over again. I'd like to talk about the most recent collection, which is Deepening Groove. And earlier I've done some research on you, and I think you said about instrumentality that you were not seeking cohesion in that book. In Deepening Groove, I see a cohesion in a new way, and it almost, Ravi, for me, begins with its epigraph, which is from Lucretius, Dererum Natura, I think that's loosely translated as let us examine on the nature of things, and then the epigraph is actually, let us examine if it be finite. And somehow I think that sets the tone for what you're doing here. Am I right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that second book was such a different process. I mean, my first book was gestated out of my dissertation, my creative dissertation at Columbia, when I had a draft of a publishable manuscript. And, you know, 99, I think maybe one poem from that actually made it into instrumentality. But I worked with it, and it becomes a kind of anthology of the best work that you've done to that point. I think a lot of first books are that way. But this the second collection, I found myself reacting to nature and utilizing this form that had a lot in common. And it just kind of happened. I was out at the McDowell Colony in New Hampshire after living in Brooklyn and being in the city for a long time. And somehow that exposure to nature made me realize not just the glory of the world around us, but also a lot about my perception and how I altered what I perceived in some way or was part of this landscape that I was also observing. And so these poems came out, I call them post-pastorals. They're all in the same form. They're all four little tercets, four three-line stanzas, and yet I attempt to compact a lot in there. And
ask you a question about the changes that you made between the two books, the 30 stills, which I bought when it came out, so I own that one. And so
yeah.
I have not only 30 stills, but I have Deepening Groove. And what I see is that you reordered the poems from the 30 stills as you created it and blended it with newer, longer poems that are not in this form of the four tercets, four stanzas of three lines. So let me just ask you one simple question about that, and then you can talk more extensively about it. So let's just say, for example, in Buzzards in 30 Stills moves from position 30 to number 2, Oyster from 22 to number 3. What was going on there?
Well, that's such a perceptive question, and I think some of that was unconscious. That book, 30 Stills, was really a gift, because I live in the town with the late, great, eminent American artist, Sol LeWitt, and had gotten to know him around the same time that I was writing these poems. I ended up writing, I think, 60 total of these pastorals, and I thought it actually would make it very easy to assemble. I have an entire manuscript here, and they're all the same form, and they relate conceptually, and I can just kind of put them together. But what I found was in assembling a manuscript, the reader needed interstices and spaces to stop and breathe. And that's why I included, ultimately, these longer poems in Deepening Groove. Seamless Matter, Sol LeWitt was kind enough to give me one of his paintings to use on the cover. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, he let me use this. And Rain Taxi, this terrific publisher out in Minneapolis, is just starting a new chapbook series called Ohm Edition. They've always done these beautiful handcrafted chapbooks, mainly of poets who have accomplished a lot and are kind of in the final phases of their career, and they wanted to start a chapbook series for kind of younger, more emerging poets. And so I had this project and this cover art at the same time that they were looking for a book for the series, and so it was this wonderful synchronicity and all came together. And I think with 30 Stills, I wanted the moments to be almost more discreet in some way, that they kind of had the ability to shimmer on their own. And in Deepening Groove, I really kind of wanted to build a kind of a musical architecture, almost an arc where as you read more and more, you got a bigger sense of not just these post-pastorals, but also the speaker's identity and a little bit about voyaging.
Yeah.
A little bit about my heritage. Yes, exactly.
Yes, it also ends the book. The last poem in the book is a gorgeous, gorgeous love poem. It's just beautiful. I wonder if you have it in front of you. Do you have it, the book in front of you, at the moment?
I should. I'm kind of wandering around my study.
Well, that's okay.
I
You may find it. I'd just like you to maybe read a couple of stanzas of that beautiful love poem at some point in this show. So just take your time as you walk around your office.
Yeah, and there's a little story I'll tell about that too. So sure.
I would love to have that. Why don't we get the story? What's the story?
Okay. Well, I think that poem was probably one of the most difficult poems for me to have to write and perform, even though I have in the past I performed at the Dodge Poetry Festival and out in L.A. in front of 5,000 people, and all of these occasions were not nearly as stressful as having to write a poem for a very good friend's wedding. And so that actually is an epithalmium, a poem for a wedding, and I was kind of commissioned by one of my old college friends to be part of the program, and there was going to be a musician, and he wanted me to write this poem. And so it was very difficult, especially considering reading it in front of friends and family, and that it would kind of encapsulate his love and be a marker to the ceremony. And I had a lot of trouble writing it, and I actually was going on a midnight canoe ride when I was out at the Blue Mountain Center in the Adirondacks. And
which is how the poem starts. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Starts with that canoe ride, doesn't it?
Yeah, I was just on my own, and I was just thinking about how I was navigating this canoe in the dark along this water, and how that experience would be different if I had someone in the canoe with me. That two people paddling, if they're in synchronicity, could kind of be an apt metaphor for the working out of a marriage. And so that's kind of how the beginning of the poem came to me, and I used that as a jumping-off point for that.
Well,
yeah,
I had retrieved
the book, so I can read it anytime.
Okay, well, why don't you just read maybe the first three stanzas through the line purpose, and that'll give us a real
sure.
sense of the poem. That'd be great if you could do that. Let's hear
absolutely
your beautiful too. Voice.
So this is for my friend Michael Weisberg and Sharon Pasek, who actually just had a little boy, Soren, 5 months ago, so
oh,
late
wow.
with human love. Seen from canoe stem on a moonless night, the cosmos stretches boundlessly above, a panoply of stars and the whitish curve of the Milky Way, leaving the lone paddler significantly insignificant, utterly diminutive, yet part of some larger, grander tapestry unable to fully fathom. Human love is like that, for when it appears, it affirms the person before us, not as projection or romantic ideal, but as who our beloved in actuality is. When you love, it is paradoxically not you who love, but love which acts through you, imbuing the mortal life with divine purpose.
I think that is so gorgeous. I just read that and copied it down and put it in my journal. I loved it so much. I think it's just beautiful, beautiful love poem. One of the things also that you've mentioned here is that this poem is dedicated. And as I look through the collection, the poems are dedicated over and over again. The stills are dedicated, and virtually all of them are to poets. Oyster for Sandra Beasley, Tideline for Gray Jakubik, Peacock for Mark Doty, Indian Elephant for, I can't pronounce this one very well, but Priya Sarukai Chakria, another poet, and so on. I could go on and on and on. There is so much generosity here in doing this. What are you thinking as you're doing this?
Well, in some instances, the poem was a direct result of a conversation that I've had. I mean, I feel very much that writing, though it's an isolated act, puts you in contact with a community of individuals. And really, none of us would be where we are without all of these people. And so in some instances, like Mark Doty has that wonderful poem about a peacock. And so when I was writing mine, and that I certainly was in the back of my mind, As I wrote that. Other poems, there's a poem called Fireflies for this Iranian dancer and translator and poet Nilufar Taleby, and we actually spent an evening with a number of writers and actually a scientist who was talking about the reasons why fireflies light up and that, and, you know, and this kind of mating ritual, really. And so that came out of that experience, so it was only apt that I dedicated the poem to her.
Yeah,
so.
There's a chemical inside that firefly tail that I actually use myself in something I've read in Who by Fire, because it simulates fire, that chemical inside that
tail that
produces that light.
How did it make you feel?
I'm sorry?
I said, how did that make you feel, putting that luciferance or whatever it is? Yeah.
Oh yeah, it took me on a different, a whole tangent of the whole idea of sort of somehow fire and light and love. I think firefly is somehow a symbol of love from my own childhood. I don't know about yours, but from collecting them, and you know, it's kind of a first experience of sort of experiencing nature in this very close and safe way.
Absolutely, and that's why in that poem I use this Japanese word hotaru, because in the Japanese language, in Japanese mythology, apparently that word both means a kind of love, a kind of transcendent love, and it means fireflies, which are seen as the transmigrating souls of the dead in Japanese mythology. And so there's that wonderful conflation of all of those things. Yeah.
Oh, that is so cool. I love that. You know, this brings me to a very loving thing that you did, and it's a somewhat difficult topic. It deals with Radha. I'd like to talk to you about Radha Says, and these are the last poems of Retika Vazirani, who, as you point out in the foreword, these poems are somewhat inescapably associated, for some at least, with her decision in 2003 to take her own life, preceded by killing her 3-year-old son, Jihan. And you managed to be the recipient of the manuscript that she had written beforehand. But before we get to this manuscript, which I think you did an extraordinary, you and the other editor, an extraordinary job with this, I'd like to ask you a question which is on people's minds who know artists, and that is, do you believe, as some have asserted, particularly in the wake of her death, which is fairly recent, that occurred in D.C. where I live, so I knew a lot about it at the time, that the choice of the creative life in the arts that is fraught with rejection, Robbie, some might say rejection is the name of the game, that the risks to one's sense of success in the world are higher if we choose to work in the arts full-time?
Yeah, I think that certainly could be theorized. I mean, I think in the case of Retika, she had a history of depression in her family. Her father actually took his own life as well. But the amazing thing was that I knew her from when I was an undergraduate at the University of Virginia, and she was had just finished going to graduate school there, and someone put us in touch, and I didn't know any South Asian poets at all. I was kind of a poet in secret. You know, I don't think my father would have been happy at that point. And she was just, I want to ask you about that
before you're done, too.
But you know, I was just a college sophomore or something, and she was wonderfully generous and helpful with me. And so over the years, I kind of, when we were putting together the anthology Language for a New Century, she helped connect me with a number of different poets. And you know, she taught yoga. She had this wonderful presence. And so for me, I actually had breakfast with her and Jahan and Yusuf Kuminyaka, who was her partner, probably 6 weeks before this
happened.
For
our listeners, that's a very well-known poet who won the Pulitzer Prize. Go ahead.
Yes, it was amazing to me that we never really know the freight that someone carries within them. You know, I've only subsequently found out kind of what she was going through, but she was always, even up until that last point, very generous and helpful. And you know, I think, yes, what we do is fraught with rejection, but I think we're also compelled to do what we do because artists possess a certain sense of exploration, which can be very dangerous, can be precipitously close to madness. And so I think that there's that as well.
Goethe has had his comments on that, imagination and madness.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, she was, I think, a really seminal figure. I mean, the history of Asian American poetry is pretty young still, and other than perhaps Amina Alexander or Vijay Seshadri, I mean, Ritika had kind of established herself and won the Barnard New Woman's Poetry Prize and was published by Copper Canyon. And I think 5 years, over 5 years had passed since she passed away. Before I was contacted by her estate to work on this. And so I felt obliged simply from knowing Ritika to look at the manuscript. And I actually intended to help, you know, place it somewhere. Apparently Copper Canyon had it for a number of years and ultimately, for a number of reasons, I'm sure, decided not to do it. It's hard to not have an author there to promote the book, but I also completely agree. I think the idea of infanticide is something that is an utter taboo and something that people are not comfortable with. And so I think even now, I mean, I think she should be a more well-known poet than she is. And it's amazing to me that her memory has already started to recede a little.
To help turn our listeners away from that autobiographical reading, I'd like to talk to you about some of the extraordinary things that are in the back of this book, because you did have a chance to look at the manuscript. We get to actually see her editing. And one of the edits that she does so magically is on the poem, I'm looking for the first word of this, but it's honey, soul, body, rose. Do you remember what is the first word from that poem? It's from that poem,
yes.
But so I have the first
beyond
word.
Yeah, beyond honey, soul, body, and
beyond,
rose.
Beyond honey, soul, body, and rose. And she's writing about Charlie Parker, and she does this beautiful stanza in which we see it in four or five different forms until her final version, in which she says, "He says he wishes he could shun running. Does he wish he lives? Does he wish he could live to play, not the other way around?"
Mm-hmm.
And this brings me, I know, this brings me to a Charlie Parker quote that I want to ask you about. Charlie Parker, the great sax player, is said to have said, "If you haven't lived it, it won't come out of your horn." What do you think of that one?
I like that. I mean, I think that the jazz musicians are the sages among us all, but you know, I think I would agree to it, except to the extent that I think that the imagination is a completely unconstrained and boundless force, and that you can do things in the imagination that pure experience doesn't necessarily need to be the prerequisite for. So, you know, I think for the most part, absolutely, that's true, but I wouldn't want to feel like I couldn't perhaps write about something, explore something, because I didn't have the hands-on experience about it.
I absolutely and totally agree. And this brings me to, this is the sort of thing we might tell our students, and I'm sure you must talk about this sort of thing when you're teaching. And I've spent a lot of years in the classroom teaching creative writing as well. And I want to quote you in, taking you out of context a little bit here too. There's a place in where you were talking about revision, and you said missteps are important. And I loved that because I myself firmly believe that all creativity involves by its nature failure, and that in a way we need to be able to instill our students with the ability to actually not succeed in the workshop. Not
yeah.
do the perfect thing, not write the perfect poem.
Absolutely. I love kind of making that part of the framework or the process. I mean, I'll just add to that a couple of things. And going back to Japan, they have that wonderful idea of wabi-sabi, which, going back to your idea of the crack letting the light in, it's this notion in Japanese aesthetic that the flawed object is the rare object and the one of beauty. And so when you have a glazed pot in a kiln and it actually kind of shards or fragments, it actually makes the pot more valuable and rare than the kind of perfectly smooth, homogenous glazed pot. So,
Or the broken pot that's repaired is maybe more perfect than the... Right.
Yeah, and Samuel Beckett used to always say that the process of making art is learning how to fail better, right? And
yes.
You know, I think... You need to kind of say, and you never know. I mean, sometimes you can be going the wrong direction for a really long time, and that leads you to a place that takes you in a totally different direction, and that's the real right path that you need to follow. And you would never know it if you hadn't kind of taken these wrong steps before. So I think it's...
And the way you came full circle to my introduction, I'd like to come full circle to the shedding of light, because you have a new project. And the new project is called Hide and Seek Muse. Lisa Russ Spar is involved with this with you. And I want you to tell us about this, how you're going to get poetry back in the national dialogue, and those listening should go to drunkenboat.com as Ravi tells you about this before we close the show. Tell us, Ravi,
yep.
about this new project.
Absolutely. Well, this book by Ritika Rava says was the first book Drunken Boat did. We're available free online, drunkenboat.com, and have been around for now. We're entering our 12th year, and for a long time, so much of what we publish can only exist online, from video to web art to interactive fiction. But when we get these extraordinary projects like Ritika's book, and in this case, Lisa Russ Spar, who's a terrific Guggenheim-winning poet and editor in her own right, but she was also the chronicler of higher education's arts and academe poetry blogger for 2 years, and every Monday she would post a poem and do kind of a close reading of this poem, but it started to become almost a cultural commentary. And really, reading these, and I kind of call them micro-essays, makes us realize how crucial poetry still is and how it illuminates all of the issues that are surrounding it.
And you have a Kickstart. You have a Kickstart campaign related to this too. So I think you should mention that so we can help get you some funding for it.
Yes, that would be wonderful. Yeah, if you just go to drunkenboat.com, the Kickstarter announcement's on there. The book is called The Hide and Seek Muse: Annotations on Contemporary Poetry, and it has a number of wonderful poets. Nick Flynn is doing the intro, and we're just trying to raise some money to get these funds, because we think this is a book that everyone from the scholar with the PhD to someone who's just an curious, literate individual would love to pick up, and it makes poetry accessible and interesting in this very readable way. And
can you tell me a little bit about
what
the Hide and Seek Muse has to do with all this?
Well, it is the name of one of the little essays Lisa writes, but I think it also is kind of getting at this the very idea we're talking about, the capriciousness of the creative impulse, and
yes,
how
yes.
you know sometimes you have to look in a different place than you thought to find what you didn't know that you needed.
And maybe you need to find a way to just wait so that the spirit can move into you, as you've said.
Right, yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this has been a wonderful conversation. I'd like to close with the poet philosopher Edmond Jabez, who said, "If there is no risk, there is no writing." And may I say, Ravi, even before we met here today, I believe that you and I had connected through that belief. I think we share that.
Absolutely. And this conversation has just confirmed it in my mind. So it's been a real pleasure. I felt like we could have gone on for another hour or so.
So do I. And I hope we will another time. Good afternoon, Ravi Shankar, and thank you for being on Rare Bird Radio.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mary.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Left you on the debris at the Sunday morning market. You were sorting through the odds and ends. You was looking for a bargain. I heard your footsteps at the front door. You knew you'd find me waiting there at the top of the stairs. At the depot, with the General Workers Union, and yet that they'll never change a thing. Well, they won't fight, and they're not working. Left you on the debris.